The drivers there are obviously the scale of agriculture and the scale of nutrient applications that we need to maintain our commodity systems. That's one just mismatch to the natural levels of nutrients in our ecosystems, but also flow and water volume from the landscape. So agencies like NOAA are going to be looking at this, like how much precipitation do we have in the sub-basins of the Mississippi River, and then how much actual flow contributions to the Mississippi River from those sub-basins. So flow, and that, of course, that's driven by precipitation, slope, and soil texture and soil management. So those are some things, but then also where we have losses of our buffering landscapes.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Boost your yields with KWS Hybrid Rye featuring Pollen Plus technology. Learn more at kws.com. Grow a carbon crop below your row crop. Add carbon to your balance sheet with Loam Bio.
Welcome to the Crop Science Podcast Show, brought to you by Wyzenetics. I am Brian Arnell, and I'm coming to you from the campus of Oklahoma State University. Today, I'm excited to have on with us Dr. Beth Baker. She is the Associate Professor, Extension Professor in the Department of Wildlife, Fisheries, and Aquaculture at Mississippi State University. Dr. Baker's role in Extension is focused on natural resource conservation and agroecosystems throughout the Mississippi River Basin, with a particular emphasis on mitigating nutrient transport from working agriculture landscapes to aquatic ecosystems. She and her team conduct on-farm research and extension education centered on conservation practices and ecosystem services with the support from state and federal agencies. She has served as chair of a multi-state working group that supports research and outreach goals of the Mississippi River Gulf of Mexico Hypoxia Task Force, and has recently served as a member of the National Climate Change Working Group. Beth, thank you so much for taking the time to join us today.
Yeah, good to be here.
So as I always ask, you know, share with the audience of your path to being an extension specialist. Now, we got to keep this brief, you know, but, you know, in a minute or so, share, you know, how did you end up in this profession at Mississippi State?
Definitely a serendipitous path. So I'm originally from Minnesota. I grew up in St. Cloud, Minnesota, which is on the Mississippi River, about 3 hours from the headwaters. And I really thought I was going to go biomedical route. So I started there in pre-med and started doing some environmental research. And that led me to do a bit of a master's in environmental toxicology. Mm-hmm. And thought from there, I just wanted to be, you know, program manager for research, but ran into a professor from Mississippi State at a conference, and he offered me a PhD position. And I initially thought, I have no idea where that is. I can't do that. But I came down for a visit here to the campus in Starkville, and I just loved the university. Moved here to do my PhD, and through about a year here, I transitioned to a professional role while I finished my PhD, and then kind of after my advisor left, took over his program and rolled right into an extension professor position.
Fantastic. Well, I'm hoping your visit wasn't in the middle of summer.
It was close. It was April, but it was beautiful. Yeah.
Oh, that's fantastic. April's not bad. I always joke, only time I get to go north to, you know, like Minnesota, North Dakota, and Canada is in January. And I really wish they'd invite me another time besides first part of January.
Yeah, you need to go in July.
I agree. So Beth, tell us a little bit about the work that you're doing at Mississippi State.
You know, the work that we do is always, you know, changing with the funding landscape. But when I came in, we were doing a good bit of edge of field conservation assessments. So working with grade control structures or water control structures, as well as water holding facilities, and doing all the on-farm assessment of those so that we could document the benefits of conservation, mm-hmm. how great of stewards we have here in Mississippi, and all the benefits of their conservation adoption. And, you know, over time, as the funding landscape's changed, we've continue to do some edge of field water quality assessments and focus there, but then also into the soil health space, mm-hmm. and now climate change mitigation, all parts of, you know, the way biogeochemistry happens on the landscape, but looking at it from different lenses so that we can think about conservation systems on our farms and not just individual practices.
So I want to ask you, before we get into science, I want to ask you more of an extension question, because I always feel this is an interesting, area to work in. So, you know, you're working with farmers, and as you stated, you're working with some amazing farmers that are trying. One of the challenges that we often get in extension, especially in a role such as yours, is that while we acknowledge that we have some great working partners in the field in agriculture, they also may not be perfect, and some of their current practices could be improved. As an extension specialist, as a researcher, how do you approach these farmers in a way to say, you know what, we understand you're doing your best, or as you perceive your best, but we found these problems. How do you address that as a specialist?
I really take my role pretty seriously in terms of servant leadership and serving our stakeholders. So if there's practices that are not as optimal as they could be, I take that on as my responsibility, right? Like, there's information and there's research and there's education that we can do, and we can't reach every single landowner. There's so many folks out there. Rural areas are, you know, hard to really connect with people in rural areas sometimes, especially some of our smaller landowners. So I take collaboration and networking in that kind of space really seriously, so that we can make sure that we are sharing any of the research coming out of the university in multiple different ways, right? Because people are going to hear it differently too. So sometimes a profitability approach might work for one person. Sometimes a stewardship approach might work for one person. Sometimes a fear of regulation might actually work for another person. It just depends on how folks, where their mindset is, how they hear information, and what their goals are.
So as you look at your region in Mississippi, what are you seeing as the drivers of nutrient loss?
Great question. So, and a complex question at that, you know, so there's a lot of research across the federal and state agencies on this. And really the drivers there are obviously the scale of agriculture and the scale of nutrient applications that we need to maintain our commodity systems. That's one just mismatch to the natural levels of nutrients in our ecosystems, but also flow and water volume from the landscape. So agencies like NOAA are going to be looking at this, like how much precipitation do we have in the sub-basins of the Mississippi River, and then how much actual flow contributions to the Mississippi River from those sub-basins. So flow, and that, of course, that's driven by precipitation, slope, and soil texture and soil management. So those are some things. But then also where we have losses of our buffering landscapes, like riparian areas, lowland wetlands, anything like that. And you can layer on top of that any changes in weather, climate, natural disasters that would be driving more drought conditions or flood conditions that now we have to think about.
I'm going to kind of my follow-up question to that is, it's interesting for me. So I get an opportunity to work in your area quite a bit on the nutrient management and agriculture side, because that's where my world is, that there are some agricultural practices because of the amount of water and the soil types that are dominated by Mississippi, some of your heavy clays, you know, the practice of bedding and tillage, which is when you move into my region, we don't do that much. We don't have to worry about water flow. We don't have to worry about getting the plants above a lot of surface. So bedding isn't something, and tillage isn't something. How do you work riparian strips and those buffer strips into this almost necessary tillage in some soil types and environments?
And I love that you're familiar with our agriculture landscapes, because that's usually where we have to kind of start in describing them. But the systems you're describing to are really most common in the Mississippi Delta region, like in our Delta. So outside of the Delta, we can still have row crop that's sometimes non-irrigated, sometimes not on beds, offering a little more opportunity for that drainage water management, because that's, you know, one of the practices you're describing in the Delta necessitate a drainage system of pads and pipes around the field that would circumvent a buffered system and move water more rapidly off the field, which in that region, excess moisture in the field can be the number one crop risk. So it's totally necessary, but it does create a water management, nutrient management challenge for those edge of field and downstream systems. So that's where some of the work that we did early on came in with in-ditch management, like water control structures that would create mini wetland lake habitats, but not impede flow downstream. So you can have more sediment dropout, phosphorus dropout, nitrogen removal, depending on the vegetative system. Two-stage ditches were another practice in those areas, which just creates a small floodplain basically more surface area for vegetation and nutrient removal. And then downstream, you know, wetland systems, if the landscape's suitable for a restoration.
So the two-stage ditch is a new term to me. I'm not familiar with that one. Describe that a little bit.
Yeah, a lot of that research is out of the Ohio area, and then we have some here out of Mississippi, but it's really just widening the ditch and then regrading it so that it's got a floodplain shelf on it.
Okay.
It's as much about bank stabilization as it is about vegetative surface and removal of nutrients.
So how, when we're looking at this, because, I hate to keep going back to it, but the bedded area is the one that I get to deal with the most. It always kind of intrigues me because the soils in there are typically a heavy clay often. The beds are necessary. The implementation of these structures to create these mini wetlands, is that something that most farmers are doing? Is it something that is supported by maybe EQIP? You know, where's some of the introduction of this coming from?
Yeah, each one of these practices would be like EQIP or CSP supported. Mm-hmm. And the benefit of them being in ditch is that it doesn't impede any infield management. You know, we can get more voluntary adoption of a in-ditch conservation practice often. That's not going to impact what's happening in the field, timing of what's happening in the field, than something that would start changing that bedded system, planting all of the things.
No, it makes sense. Instead of asking a farmer to take 5% of their area out of production to create a riparian zone, or, you know, have to worry about spray tractor tracks and such, is to use that ditch. That's a really, I hadn't heard about that. So that's a really fascinating area. I'll keep going through some of the notes that we have on your talk. So what are some of the, as we talk about this nutrient loss, what are some of the unintended consequences of these excess nutrients?
I like this question because oftentimes folks like jump right to the Gulf of Mexico, which we are not all right next to. That doesn't make the most sense to everybody.
Yeah.
And it shouldn't, because really, you know, a lot of the unintended consequences can happen much more locally. So if you think about local lakes across the whole Midwest, when we have excess nutrients, that can create excess algal growth, right? Mm-hmm. And that can be a major nuisance for safe recreation on any of our inland lakes or rivers, as well as if you've got animal waste, you might have pathogen inputs as well, which can create unsafe recreation. And even the growth of invasive aquatic plants, which can not only impede recreation, fishing, but also transportation. So you're talking about all these other services that we and our producers are accustomed to using, because not mm-hmm. just because you're a producer doesn't mean you're not also recreating on the local lake with your family. And, you know, in an area where, being from the Midwest, in an area where lake property is valuable, that can drive down lake properties as well. That aquatic plant growth can really impede transportation on our major river systems as well, and even hydropower systems, if that's part of a dammed structure. And then you've got areas around the country where that fresh water is also drinking water. So whether it's nitrates in groundwater, and that's the drinking water source, or algal growth in Lake Erie, the Ohio River Basin, that threatens drinking water safety. So then you've got these other, you know, human concerns. And you could take it all the way down to the nutrient loading to the Gulf of Mexico uh-huh. and how it impacts fisheries there. And that ultimately is not the nutrients that impact the fisheries directly, but nutrients that spur algal growth. And when that algae dies, it sucks oxygen out of the water. So that can impact like those low oxygen levels. That can happen in the Gulf of Mexico, but that could happen in a stream that you fish for trout. That's also really important to you. So I really like the local impacts and examples so much more than just jumping right to the Gulf of Mexico.
Makes a ton of sense. So folks, right now you're listening to the Crop Science Podcast Show, and we have on with us Dr. Beth Baker, an associate professor, an extension specialist in the Department of Wildlife, Fisheries, and Aquaculture at Mississippi State. Beth, as we move through this, we've talked a little bit about the ditch management and some of the riparian. What are some of the other conservation strategies that can be implemented to manage nutrient loss?
Absolutely. You know, we always try to focus on things we can control, because there's plenty of things we can't control out in the systems. And some of this, Brian, falls in your wheelhouse, obviously, because I like to think about it from the top of the transport chain. Mm-hmm. down to our ecosystems. And that top of the transport chain is all nutrient management, thinking about enhanced efficiency fertilizers, and you know how we manage infield, whether that's reducing tillage in the system, adding living cover throughout the year with a cover crop or whatever it may be, and then moving to edge of field. So everything that happens in field is the top of that chain. So whether someone's using integrated pest management, irrigation efficiency techniques for making sure we're using irrigation properly, all that fits together in the system right at the field. That's where you're going to kind of get your most bang for your buck, if you will, because that's a lot of times if you're saving on nutrient management, that's a major value add, right? Every one of those steps would have a value add to the profitability of the system. And then you get to the edge of field. And that's where you start thinking about drainage water management a little more specifically, because you're trying to manage the runoff that's now leaving the field, because those nutrients aren't going to leave the field if there's not water leaving the field. And so we're talking about water management, whether it's in pads, pipes. Here is what we're looking at: pads, pipes, and ditch water management. If you're in the Midwest, that's going to be tile drainage, and you're thinking about bioreactors, subsurface treatment, and then into the ditch water management. So you still have some of the ditch water management there in the Midwest. But down here, if we don't have pads and pipes, you could think about buffer systems, field borders, field buffers, vegetative structures, essentially, or vegetative area that slow water, dropout sediments and associated phosphorus usually, and then the vegetation would be removing nitrogen too. And then you want to try to replicate that down in the ditch system.
So you've kind of hit on it, but can you give a little bit more of a description when you mention pads and pipes, right?
Yeah.
That's a little bit of a area specific terminology. So can you kind of dive into that just briefly?
For sure. Yeah. And it is very specific kind of to our Mississippi Delta growing systems, where most of those fields often can be laser leveled to a very minimal grade. And when that happens, there's usually a pipe structure put into that field as well, which has a dual purpose, if you will. So it definitely has a purpose for in-season water management to get water off the field. And then the pads are basically like raised dirt structures. Often they end up being farm roads around it as well. So it contains all of the water within the field and then drains it all to a point. It also keeps all the management activities within that field area. So that's the pads and pipe structure. Dually, some of our fields that producers might manage for waterfowl hunting in the winter, actually, those pipes allow for them to drop in boards to store water in the winter for hunting purposes. So kind of cool there.
So, and I'm going to take one more step back also, because you and I are just saying the word nutrient. What nutrients are we really talking about?
We're talking primarily about nitrogen and phosphorus.
Absolutely. So as we look at the conservation, and I think that's a good point, is in this Delta region, and even as you move up in states north of you, the recreation aspect, specifically the waterfowl, how does that play in? Because now you got a lot more water movement to me. I mean, now you're throwing in, it could be beneficial for the system, or it might be challenging for the system. So where does the introduction of the created wetlands for waterfowl, does that help you on nutrient transport, or does it make some challenges at times?
You know, that water holding would only happen in the winter during the fallow season. In a way, it could help with reducing nitrogen transport offsite. So most of that's going to be lost into a gaseous form once it's held there in a wetland system. But growers that would be, you know, putting in boards to hold water for the winter for habitat, that can also be incentivized through our Farm Bill conservation programs like EQIP or CSP. And oftentimes, if it's a natural resource enterprise, if you will, you know, hunting club, then there's additional added value there. So I think one of the main concerns of a trade-off is if that wetted period in the winter leads to more locked up phosphorus going into the growing season, that's a concern. But the growers that do it seem to circumvent any of those, you know, nutrient limitations when they enter the growing season.
So this may be left field, and we may have to drop it off. Who knows? When I'm thinking about the wetland, especially in the Delta, because you're not freezing, the system's still cycling, does that wetland overwinter increase soluble phosphorus once the water's released, or has that even been looked at? Because I'm thinking we now have plant degradation in the water, potential soluble phosphorus release in that. Does that change any of the phosphorus, phosphorus dynamics in that water system?
Yeah, I don't know that offhand. I don't know how well that's been looked at, but as long as the water is being held, unless there's major rainfall that would circumvent the boards, you're kind of holding it. So the time you'd want to look at it is when boards are removed and how we could stagger board removal. So it's not like a massive flush across all fields at one time.
As we look at this, you know, one of my last questions, you know, how do these strategies help protect farm resources?
Easy one. Mm-hmm. the main thing here is all of these practices are really aimed at reducing soil loss. Like that's the number one thing, is reducing soil loss. And if we can, slow soil degradation, right? Because we think often of soil being really static as like, this is the texture, this is what I'm going to live with. But it's always in a state of degradation or formation. And so we want to push it to formation. Mm-hmm. The other main one is water security. So thinking about that, obviously, from an irrigation standpoint and having access to irrigation resources wherever we have them. But of course, many of our growers are non-irrigated. And so we still want to, you know, create buffering capacity in our landscapes or reduce vulnerability to drought mm-hmm. and flood. So that's one of the goals here with conservation systems, is to reduce that vulnerability to drought conditions and major flooding conditions. And, I think that's one area that we'll just continue to see growth in, mm-hmm. where in the past, all of our incentives programs for paying for conservation were focused on practices. Like you put in a practice, you get a payment. And now with some of our new pilot schemes through like the Climate Smart Commodities program, you're seeing a little bit more drive for pay for performance.
So I find it fascinating, at least in my region. So I want to share with our, what it looks like in Oklahoma. In the last decade, the value of wildlife to the farmer has exploded. Where 15 years ago, hunting and fishing was more of a handshake agreement that you're able to hunt and fish on places, and there was very little money change. In the last decade, we've had some significant shift in that it's now an economic source for our farmers and ranchers. And in that, we have seen a lot of conservation practices adopted that aid the wildlife now, where 15 years ago, it wasn't that case. For me, I feel like down in Mississippi, at least in that region, that the leased land and the leasing, the value of wildlife is a little bit older stake. Is that the case, or has there been a new kind of renewed interest in management of wildlife for benefit, economic benefit, but you're seeing a change in conservation because of that?
Yeah, we certainly have a strong culture of hunting and fishing here in Mississippi. And so that is certainly always a really important part of land ownership and land stewardship. But I do, just at least with the, I would say the renewed like public and private interest in it, that there's another push towards that. And then, you know, you might find new farmers, younger farmers who are even more interested in that.
It's time for our famous three.
Fascinating. Well, unfortunately, Beth, we're out of time. And so I want to move into our three standard questions that I ask all of our guests. The first is, what is your go-to work resource? If there's something that pops up, where do you go?
You know, I will say that because I'm usually trying to like orient folks around the watersheds that they're in and water quality concerns like to target, that I use the EPA How's My Waterway website a lot. It's a digital repository of all of the water quality information that's out there. And you can find where there's data near you and what impaired waters might be near you and then what the impairment concerns are.
That is a great resource. Second question, what is your favorite leisurely activity? What do you do in all the free time that you have?
I love running. And despite it being 9 million degrees here with 1,000% humidity, I still love running here. all year.
That's fantastic. I love it. And finally, where do people go to find more about your work and the work that your program's doing?
Yeah, definitely check out the Mississippi State University Extension website.
Fantastic. All right. That wraps up another episode of the Crop Science Podcast Show presented by Wisenetics. Thanks for joining us today with our guest, Dr. Beth Baker. She is Associate Extension Professor in the Wildlife Department, Wildlife Fisheries and Aquaculture Department at Mississippi State University. Remember all, if you've enjoyed this, hit that subscribe button so you receive notifications when a new podcast is released. Also, share the video with your friends if you learned something new today. Leave us comments about what you enjoyed, what you want to learn about, and potential new guests. Beth, thank you so much for taking the time with us today.
Yeah, thanks, Brian.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent from Brazil without the time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on more $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.